I'd like to talk tonight about the seeing through of distorted perception. At this point in time in our society, our culture at least here in America, the word vipassana has a number of different meanings to different people. I'd like to just clarify what vipassana really means. Many people think vipassana is a particular meditation technique, and it is in part that. Many people think vipassana is a particular tradition, and it is in part that. But really what vipassana is something beyond technique, beyond tradition, beyond culture, beyond time and place, beyond conditions. What vipassana really means is to see clearly. Seeing clearly is not just a Buddhist thing. Nor is it a Hindu thing, or a Christian thing, or a Jain thing, or a Sufi thing. Seeing clearly is our deepest potential. You could say it's our deepest possibility in terms of being a human being, is to see clearly while we are here and now. In support of seeing clearly, there's certain things that we can do. There's a certain, you might say, way of living. These ways of living are completely common sense when we're not confused or deluded. For example, to, in a way, sort out for oneself how to live in a harmless manner. How to live in a caring manner towards all things. Simply said, but a bit more difficult to actually live, but very worthy of our attention. Seeing clearly, or insight, another word sometimes that's used for vipassana, insight. By the way, vipassana is a Buddhist Pali word. The language is Pali, a bit like Sanskrit, only not quite so fanciful, not quite so for the upper class, more for the middle folk, like maybe most of us. The lower class citizens, at the time that it was developing, historically. What I'm talking about is the possibility of directly awakening into seeing things as they actually are, free from bias, prejudice, distortion. And the word things means all things or anything. For example, just seeing the breath clearly, seeing that the breath by nature comes and goes. There's an in-breath, has a beginning, middle, and end. Out-breath, beginning, middle, and end. This is the way it is. A little bit deeper, seeing that no breath is better than any other breath, like the in-breath isn't better than the out-breath. It'd be ridiculous to think of that that way, wouldn't it? My in-breath is better than my out-breath. Let me see if I can just breathe in. It'd be like that, right? Just hold it. I'm staying in the good breath. Well, the out-breath is what it's all about. Freeze frame. It's ridiculous. And that's an easy, simple example of seeing a thing clearly as it is. Another way to talk about that would be to see something like breath, body, without interfering with it. Without interfering with it. How can I see the nature of something if I'm busy manipulating it, trying to control it, change it, have it my way, adjust it, alter it, make it better? How can I see it clearly if I'm busy doing that kind of stuff, that manipulating? So I'm talking about seeing how things are really happening. And as we get interested, we don't have to be, but if we get interested in seeing how things are really happening, then what inevitably is going to arise is filters or veils, in Hinduism it's called Maya, that keeps this, or appears, yeah, to keep this clear scene from happening. This is what I want to talk about tonight. And I'm using the term distorted perception. Okay, so most of us have experienced at least at one point or other in our lives, and some of us, myself for a period of time, had an apartment that I rented on a regular basis in a state called confusion. And the state called confusion had a couple of sort of proliferations. One of them was that I had everyone around me, friends and acquaintances and people that I worked with, convinced that there was no anger in me, which guarantees that there's anger in me. I had them all convinced, oh, you're so peaceful. Oh, you're so sweet. And it was starting to sound after a while like, the other night I thought of it as, too many pancakes on Saturday morning. It starts to slide over into something that's more like a piece of cardboard than pancake. Oh, you're so sweet. Because it wasn't true. So this confusion needed to come up. See, part of what we get to do in a setting like this is at least for maybe a second or a millisecond, just let it all come up. Why not? If this, whatever's in here, why shouldn't it be able to just completely come up? And so what might come up if the brake is really released, because some of us, we take our foot off the brake, but we've got that other foot close to the emergency brake. Just in case, I want to be able to hit that emergency brake, because if it starts moving too fast, changing too quickly, don't know where it's going, not sure what's happening, I want to make sure I got a grip on things. And that's called grasping. That's called clinging. And that's a big reason why we human beings become unhappy, is because we start grasping and clinging. Sometimes we're grasping and clinging to something that we want to keep that we like. Sometimes we're trying to keep that thing we like so something else doesn't happen that we thought about before. Yeah, we'll hold on to this. Aversion, resisting something, pushing it away, is an inverted kind of grasping, if you actually consider that a little bit. So sometimes there's grief because there's loss. Little loss, bigger losses. And when we lose someone or something, there's a clear, definitive equation called the more it hurts, the longer it hurts, the more there is attachment that's working through. So grief is something that we need to come to terms with. As and when there's loss, if there's grief, it needs to be allowed. And sometimes we can protract that grief, keep a kind of a grip on that, resist that, not let the eyes release, not let the heart release. And so then we get depressed because we've got protracted grief. We can have something happen and then we get resentful. And we start holding on, and that irritability or that anger through time is resentment. And who's hurting from that resentment? Me. I'll make them pay. Who am I making pay? Me. Unfinished business. Sometimes we hold on. Again, the resentment could be there. Even the grief could be there. We don't let ourselves complete certain things. So we're walking around with some unfinished business sometimes. And you're sitting and meditating, and the back starts doing something different. You know, back there, something's going on. Pretty soon some tension arises up there, and it's building, building, maybe right up in here. It's going to the back of the neck. It's building. It's creeping round and round and round. And pretty soon there's an awareness that, oh my gosh, there's a memory in that. There's a memory in that. Oh, I feel badly about what I did. I feel badly about what I said. And sometimes there's a sense of, I need to apologize to that person. And even if they're not physically around anymore and you have no ability to contact, you can still apologize. You can let it go. It's very important to respect that. Because meditation is extremely effective and intelligent in letting it all come up if we let the meditation work. So in the Vipassana tradition of meditation, we have something called mindfulness. And mindfulness is a kind of attention. Okay, now I'm going to use some words and I'm going to make clear distinctions between these words. Because the reason why they're different words is because these different words point to different things. So this mindfulness is a certain kind of attention, I'm going to define this, that's bare. That's similar to saying it's non-interfering. Now watch. It's bare, meaning it's absent of three specific things. The first thing that it's absent of, it's bare of, is judgment. Judgment. So in bare attention, there's no good, bad, positive, negative. Guess what? That means all the sensations that have ever happened during today, and nobody could count up how many happened, all the breaths, all the thoughts. We'll just stick with today, okay? Well, let's go from 12 forward when we started meditating, or 11 forward, okay? Let's take that little window in there from 11 this morning till now. All the sensations, all the thoughts, all the emotions, all the perceptions, all the sounds, all the sights, all the smells, all the tastes, everything that happened is not positive or negative, good or bad. If it was viewed as good or bad, even just a little bit, that's judgment. That's judgment. So this bare attention is free of judging. It's also free of decision. So what we get to do in an experiment like this, this is an experiment, is hang out for a while, not needing to make any decisions about things. Okay, you had to make a decision whether to put some of that feta cheese in the salad or a sprout. And sometimes we go like this. You know, I've seen it. You know, I mean, I'm not watching you, right? Right? Because I'm doing my own practice. You know, and then, three, now two. You know, and get indecisive there about something as simple as a salad. Maybe a little more tea, you know, let's do it like that. What about over here? I think I'll sit in that seat. I'm going to go that seat. I want to sit next to them. Oh, they're looking kind of nice, maybe. Oh, wait a minute, I don't want to sit next to them. I sat next to that one last time. I don't know about that. That wouldn't necessarily be a good idea for my practice. I need a little bit more stillness. Maybe I'll go out of the dining hall. Maybe I'll just kind of like skip that altogether. Actually, it's a little too cold outside. I better stay in. I'm moving into the third thing that is bare in this attentiveness, this mindfulness, and that's called commentary. Okay? Our minds have, brain mind, thinking mind, has a tendency to have a lot of commentary. Okay? Commentary about this. And even as we're sitting here, it's like, what's the need for a news report on this? There was a need for commentary, but that the mind can have commentary. And again, look at how these things overlap. The commentary can become judgmental. Oh, that was better. Oh, I had a better sitting. Oh, after the yoga, it was really nice. Well, wait a minute, after the yoga, it was less nice. I'm not doing that yoga anymore. Actually, I want to do some of that yoga. They sounded like they were having fun in there when they went, I missed that, you know. Actually, it's cold upstairs. What the heck's going on here? It's cold upstairs. I mean, Ellen said it was going to be spotty cold, like spots of cold. Wait a minute, the whole corridor is cold. Actually, down my end in my room, it's the coldest. I'm paying money for this. I mean, it got so bad once for somebody here in this judging, deciding, and commentary tendency of non-bare attention that she said to me, and I quote, I'm not coming back because the bananas are no good. Okay. You mean I couldn't put a little peanut butter between your slices of banana and warm it up for you? Because that's what I did when the banana was no good. Just put something else on it. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. And then a commentary goes on about myself, right? Not just about other people and the bananas and the cold and the this and that. I'm commenting about my meditation and how it feels in the back and the chest and my hands and da-da-da-da-da-da. I could go on and on and on. And then there can be a second where it's just seen. Oh, look at that. Commentary. Oh, look at that. Judgment. Oh, look at that. I was trying to make a decision about when I should try to sell my house. Not now. No, now. So this stuff gets to be seen. Because if it's not seen, what's it doing? It's running around in here dictating my life. It doesn't just dictate this space, fill up this space. It starts affecting how this whole thing feels. It colors my perception. Notice when I said the word distorted perception, I didn't say wrong perception, although some people would. I said distorted perception. Because if we're not careful, we say there's wrong perception, oh, there's right perception. Wrong and right. And here we go judging again. Here we go making decisions about what's wrong and right. Actually, the right decision to make is that there's no wrong or right. It's not release from wrong and right. That's just a decision. Another decision. Notice the tendency to judge a decision. I think I won't make any decisions. I'll just observe the breathing. Oh, I just made a decision. So what is this bare attention? Pretty bare, huh? Pretty naked. Pretty childlike. You ever see a child playing? We were that once. We still are that. Even in these bigger bodies, making all these decisions and commenting and taking responsibility. Or maybe not. I don't know. Children playing, and they're free from decision, free from judgment, free from commentary. They're just in it. They are it. And then they're not. All of a sudden, something's got their attention, and it's not okay, and they're hurting and crying. They didn't make a decision to do that. It just happens. If we're not careful, we start getting really complicated as we get older, develop a brain that can think about everything. Everything. Including nothing. Let me think about nothing. What is nothing? Emptiness. Let me think about emptiness. What is emptiness? Let me think about Vipassana. What is Vipassana? Do I agree with what he said? I'm not sure. If we're not careful, this endless stream of judging, deciding, and commentary, born from conditioning, flows out of some undescribable place back there, it seems, in the past, and just jumps right over the simplicity of the moment and starts projecting into a future that hasn't happened. Thank goodness we have these sense doors that go. We're still here. There's a possibility of just seeing the banana and not saying it's old. There's a possibility of just seeing the clouds and not saying, oh, it's getting kind of cloudy, I like the blue better. Just seeing a little bit of ease coming through this, or a lot of bit of ease coming through this, and not turning that into something better than when it doesn't feel easy here. Just seeing what's happening. Sometimes people talk about having missed parts of their life. They look at photographs of when they were younger, and they go, oh, I wasn't really in that photograph very much, although I was in that photograph. I'm more in this sense of here and now as I look at that photograph than I seem to remember I was when I was in that photograph. And they feel regret. I lost something. Thinking about it again doesn't change it. Profundity and insight, clear seeing, comes from the space between thoughts. The space prior to thoughts, which is the same as the space after thoughts. We may actually discover at some point that we have more openness to insight when we first are awakening in the morning, before the whole story of what we think about and what we're going to do, even here on retreat. It'll come back tomorrow morning after deep sleep. It'll come right back. Oh, where am I? What am I doing? Well, wake up bell. Oh, wait a minute. I don't really want to wake up to that bell. Comes this roll. Exercise period, I didn't talk about that yet. Exercise period, no, not for me. I'm just going to roll from the left side to the right side of the body and tuck it in a little bit. That's my workout. After all, he said it was optional. All I have to do is stay quiet and not lie down in the hall. I'm going to continue to lie down in here. Oh, second bell. Uh-oh, I'm starting to feel guilty. Profundity and insight comes from the silence and stillness. Nothing with respect to awakening, to the way things really are, is going to come from listening and following the thinking mind. Check it out for yourself. Follow the thinking mind. Just walk around behind it like it's a big dog taking you for a walk. And see what comes from that, other than perhaps some exhaustion and your arms gotten jerked a bunch. That's why I'm suggesting from the very get-go, just see about the way that the silence and stillness is informing this opportunity. Not your thoughts about the silence and stillness. Not even your thoughts about what I'm saying. But if the word points well, it points into something that for at least an instant might allow space. with regards to letting things come all the way up, what we're often working through is the habit of repressing and suppressing our experience. So we're just gently loosening, taking the top off so that that defensive mechanism of suppression, repression can dissipate. People talk about wanting to be free of afflictive emotions, wanting to be free of anger and sadness and fear. What makes an emotion an afflictive emotion? What makes an emotion an afflictive emotion is that it's been judged. That is what makes for affliction. Not only that, but the afflictive emotion is identified with as mine. This is my emotion. This is happening to me. There's the affliction. The emotional energy, the unpleasantness of the emotional energy, sadness sometimes is more pleasant for this person and less pleasant for this person. Then we go over here, and this same amount of sadness, so to speak, is not unpleasant at all for this person. They actually might say, wow, this is really rich. I mean, I don't want to, like, make more of it happen, but since it's happening, I'm going for the ride. They don't feel afflicted at all. Starting to see perception in there? These afflictive emotions, as they are perceived by humans, are very much connected to the whole quadrant called perceived needs. And if the emotion is afflictive, if the state in the body and the mind is afflictive to the so-called being, person, I, then my perceived need is to get out of it, to change it. I want to say something now about why struggle is an essential part of waking up. I'm not talking about struggle meaning go out and try to find a way to struggle more. I'm talking about when struggle arises spontaneously, it's an essential, necessary part of waking up in the following way. Without apparent needs in the realm of humans, to stick with that for a moment, or animals if you want, or plants, or everything, how could we develop generosity and loving kindness if there were not apparent needs? Without suffering, how could we develop compassion? Without afflictive states, so-called afflictive states, how would we know where to look to wake up? This is kind of sounding like suffering is absolutely a necessary ingredient. How about hold off on that for a minute and just say part of the nature of this existence is the exploration and the possible transcendence of suffering. Relationships. A lot of our life is in relationship with other people. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different ones of us. Simply put, relationships are a mirror. They're a reflection of your own self-perceptions, where you are identified. When you look around this room, do you see bodies? Do you see intellects? Do you see emotions that you like or dislike? Do you see gender? Do you see race? Do you see age? Because what you see is where you're identified. That's why other people, so to speak, are perfect to show you your own self-perceptions that you're identified with. Now, this that I just described as awakenings occurring, and when I use the word awakening, I mean clarification, clear seeing, waking up to the way things really are, coming out of the waking dream that we're separate beings, and coming out of the dream that suffering is happening to me. As this happens, as these identifications, and I'm talking now about all the identifications so far that I mentioned, as they begin to be seen, eventually what happens is when you look at other beings, you begin to see that there's something in that other being that's looking at you that's the same thing that's looking at them, so to speak. There's a space where it's one being looking out of two pairs of eyes. And it's not woo-woo, and it's not like, whoa, sparkle, I see your aura. It's just really simple and direct. And part of the reason why a lot of human beings don't look in the eyes of others too long is because they're going to see that. Or they're going to see the stuff, the identifications and the distorted perceptions that are in the way of that. And so they don't want to look. This one being looking out of two pair of eyes opens up into one being looking through everything. What does that mean? It means we are the eyes and the ears of the universe. We are the light of the world. Everything is the light of the world. Including all the so-called darkness, is the light of the world. This is quite a little bit beyond in the world, but not of it. This is, we are not in the world is in us. This us is presence. Everything exists as presence. In Buddhism, it's called suchness, isness. Everything is. It's both the most personal, so-called thing, it's the most interpersonal thing, and it's transcendent or transpersonal simultaneously. So for this to arise that I'm describing experientially, because a person can feel that they understand this in their mind, oh, I understand what these words mean. That's just somebody thinking they understand what these words mean. Realizing this is not thinking about it. So it's necessary to fall through or out of the life that you think is yours. That's called identification. That's called distorted perception. It's necessary to fall through or out of the life you think you're having in order to find the life that's always present. That's the life of openness and freedom. We have tendencies to say no to things even after they've already started to happen. And in a way, it's the height of irrationality to say no to things that are already starting to happen. We say no to things that are already here, no to things that are already arising. And this no ensures that life will have pain and conflict. It ensures that life will have more friction. In terms of letting it all come up, there's this possibility of a clear differentiation between pain and suffering. And when I say pain, I mean, even a little bit more differentiated, I mean unpleasant experience. Pain is a concept we put on unpleasant experience, unpleasant feeling, unpleasant sensation, unpleasant tastes, unpleasant sights, which are sensations. We put the concept of pain on that. And when we put the concept of pain on that which is unpleasant, there is a risk that we start to suffer because we put that concept there. And the unpleasant and the pleasant just keeps going through like the tides of the ocean. Waking up doesn't mean there's no more unpleasant feeling. That's a big confusion if the mind thinks that. Unpleasant feeling will continue until this body stops. Pleasant feeling will continue to some extent until this body stops. Identification. I am this, I am that, I am not this, I am not that. This is what causes suffering. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later. Let's look clearly at the perceptual distortions now. Let's be even more precise about it. There are three areas that we look at. And in each of these three areas, there's a surface level of insight and there's a depth level of insight. And when I use the word insight, I mean there's a clear seeing that's surface and there's a clear seeing at depth. I'm going to talk about impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and selflessness, the three marks of existence for the human, marks of this existence. Number one, impermanence. Everything relative has a beginning and an end. You don't have to meditate at all to see this. Everybody agree? Dinner had a beginning and an end. Within the dinner, that particular item had a beginning and an end. This talk will have a beginning and an end. This weekend will have a beginning and an end. You can't find anything relative that doesn't have a beginning and an end. That's pretty simple. Most people have no problem recognizing that. And they take it for granted. So that's, yeah, okay. Big deal. With the help of meditation, what we begin to see is that in between the beginning and the end, all there is transition. All there is transition. All there is change. Something appears, transitions, disappears. And that's everything that we know. Everything known to us has a beginning and transition and then end. Sometimes it's very short, sometimes it takes longer. How about this body? We can't remember the beginning. We might be here for the end. That's partly why we meditate, is so that we can be free and open when it's time for this to breathe its last. Because that's a really important experience for human beings. And it has tremendous potential. Beginning, transition, ending. That means that everything is becoming something other than it was the moment before. Everything is in a process of becoming. You want to know what's going on here? A process of becoming. You want to know what people call myself? It's a process of becoming. With beginnings, transitions, and endings. Multiplicity of those. And this process of becoming is one aspect of the nature of being, or suchness, or isness. It's part of the nature of this. Not the whole thing, it's just part of it. So again, just be very clear. Everything has, everything relative, has a beginning and an end. The deeper insight that we see in, as we meditate, is that in between the beginning and end, all there is transition. Unsatisfactoriness. How can there be a lasting sense of happiness or satisfaction within a changing set of circumstances? It's impossible. But the deeper insight with regards to unsatisfactoriness is that as long as you believe you have or are a separate self, then your belief or your perception will generate grasping at what? At that which you perceive as your separate self. And what is that which you perceive as your separate self? Your body, your feelings, your thoughts, your perception, or consciousness. That's what's sitting here right now. A bunch of, well, 37 or so, body, feeling, perception, mental formation, and consciousness. When you meditate, that's what you see. And you see, if you see it clearly, the beginning of the feeling, transition, and the ending. The beginning of the thought, very subtle. Beginning of the thought, transition, end. Beginning of the sight, beginning of the hearing, beginning of the taste, transition, ending. If you believe you are this body, feeling, thought, perception, consciousness, then you will believe you need to protect it and maintain it and uphold it. And by the way, the word consciousness in this context simply means the knowing faculty. Consciousness knowing the body, consciousness knowing the feeling, consciousness knowing perception. Perception is just the view. Like liking or disliking something is a perception. It's a distorted perception. Subjective, arbitrary perception. Somebody might like the carpet, somebody else might not, somebody might like it a little bit more. You might like your cushion. Somebody else might sit on it and say, that cushion's awful. I need a chair. Well, what are you sitting on that for? It's a rock. I like it. It feels good. My cushion. My cushion, and don't take it. That's the other thing that comes up. Don't take my cushion. It's my cushion. Get off my cushion. Supposedly just kids in kindergarten and grade school do this. No, we do this, but we don't say it. Let's keep it here. So if you believe you are a separate being or self, what are you investing in there? You're investing in what's sitting right here in the form of a body, feelings, thoughts, perceptions, and consciousness. Now, in an instant, awareness, which is different than consciousness, can see this. Awareness is not an object that can be known. Awareness is a space that's all over here and has no fixed location simultaneously. Just notice this. Awareness can't be located, and it has no boundary. What's the boundary of awareness? You say, oh, the boundary of my awareness is just outside the driveway. That's a perception and a thought about awareness. This is mystery here, right? This is the part of the talk called the magical mystery tour into awareness. Very simple. Awareness doesn't need to know anything. It doesn't need to figure anything out. It simply is. And in its simplicity, it rests. It never is not resting. So awareness is different than consciousness. So this idea that I am this body, this feeling, this thought, this perception, this consciousness, and not seeing, where is the me in those things? Where is the I in those things? Of course, one can't be found, except the belief or concept says it's there. Can't actually be found, doesn't actually exist. Until that's clear, a lot of unsatisfactoriness is going to arise through grasping, identifying at the body and the feelings and the thought, my thoughts, defend my thoughts, defend my view, defend my belief, defend my consciousness. Meanwhile, we're all together in this immense intimacy that's ephemeral and transitory, relatively speaking. That's what we're sharing. An intimate, ephemeral transitoriness. Everything is changing. So what does that mean then, relatively speaking? Every time something passes, we are experiencing existential loss. It's not bad news nor good news. It's part of the nature of things. Regardless of your position, regardless of your health, regardless of how wonderful you feel about yourself, how much money you have or don't have, where you live, how many friends you have, how nice people are to you, how many nice things you have or not nice things you have, everybody across the sphere that we're in is experiencing existential loss moment to moment. This is what the Buddha was going, don't miss this. Don't miss this. You need to see this if you want to wake up to the way things really are. So this fluidity of aggregates, when I use the word aggregate now, I'm talking about the body, the feeling, the perception, the thought formations and consciousness. These things, as we meditate, can become fluid. In other words, they loosen up and they start to flow more freely. Yeah? A little bit of fluidity in the body, maybe this afternoon at times, maybe more fluidity just tomorrow. Okay, as we go into the meditation, maybe more fluidity with the feelings, sense perceptions. Everything starts to become fluid. You start to see this. That feels good to most people. But they may still be believing that they are that group of aggregates. And even more specifically, that they are the feeling. More than the thought. More the feeling. Because that's where the identification is. I'm more the feeling. Or I'm the perception. Or I'm the consciousness. Where does the sense of I arise in relation to these aggregates? Because it usually arises. And when I use the word sense of I, that's what I mean. The sense of I. Where is the sense of I arising right now? And which of the aggregates is it arising, you might say, with? Is it the body? Is it the feeling? Is it the thoughts? Is it the perception? Is it the consciousness? Because where that sense of I is arising, that's where identification is. And please, do not hear this as identification is wrong. Don't identify. Identification is what it is. See it for what it is. Just see it for what it is. So as the body loosens up and becomes fluid, the feelings, the thoughts, perception, usually what's remaining for many people is the identification with consciousness. I am the consciousness. I am the one who's knowing things. I am the one who's knowing things. I am the one that's seeing things. I am the one that's hearing things. We can't find that I, but we stick it there with our thoughts and belief. Without evidence to back it up. That's the big irony. It's a profound irony. And ultimately, it's a profound distortion. It's not true. But the consequence of not seeing clearly, this is where it becomes really, really interesting. And that's dealing with the third, the deepest teaching, relatively speaking, the deepest teaching of the Buddha. And this is the teaching that the mind has the hardest time understanding, which is the teaching of selflessness Sometimes it's called no-self or non-self. Sometimes the word not-self is used. It's all pointing at the same thing. Here's the way it works. Because everything relative arises and falls because of conditions. Let's just take it simple again with dinner. Dinner arose because of conditions. Some people cooked it for us. There was some food that was grown. It was brought together. It was shipped here. There's a whole lot of conditions and causes behind that. And then that meal showed up. And we ate it. Everything arises because of causes and conditions. But because everything is becoming something other than it was a moment before, remember that? Then nothing actually exists. Because existence connotes duration in time. Say it again. Everything relative arises and passes because of causes and conditions. But because everything is becoming something other than it was a moment before, nothing actually exists. Because existence requires duration in time. That's why there's no self. There's no enduring, stable, or separate I or me or self. In the feelings, in the thoughts, in the body, in the perception, or in the consciousness. Most of us have taken at least a look at this thing called the quark, right? Q-U-A-R-K. Did I say it right? Quark.
Quark.
The quark exists and doesn't exist at the same time in the following way. The quark exists as the building block for the subatomic particle, and it doesn't exist in that the quark doesn't exist in isolation. Everything we know about them is deduced from the examination of other particles. And just as an interesting aside, this whole proposal for the quark came shortly after this scientist Murray Gell-Mann, 1961 formulation of the particle classification system known as the Eightfold Way. Perhaps he hadn't studied the Buddha's teachings. If you're identified with the process of becoming as what you are singularly, and I'm not saying we're not the body, we're not the feeling, we're not the thought, I'm just saying we're not them only. If you're identified with the process of becoming as what you are singularly, then even if you're comfy and have all you want or think you need, you'll never really wake up. You won't discover what you really are because you're being held or suspended in the process of becoming. You are going round and round in samsara. And I like to describe samsara as a birth canal. Waking up is coming into the light, free from the birth canal of samsara. Perpetually wandering in the identification with body, with feelings, with thoughts, with perception, having a short, all too short break from it all, unconsciously in deep sleep, we awaken again, so to speak, we think we do, into the dream of that samsara, starting up the next morning with thought, the feeling. Why? Because of identification with those formations. If you try to get rid of those formations, it's like trying to commit suicide. And when it gets bad enough in those formations, when the identification is so bad and thick and convoluted and complex, people sometimes do want to kill themselves because they want out of it. And there's a big question there. Big question there. What happens when you take that action? Out of aversion to what's here, out of hatred to what's here, out of denial of what's here, out of intolerance, out of ignorance, what happens next? Big mystery. Russian roulette. But clearly, I hope you see that if you're identified with this process of becoming, then you will be suspended within it. And you can't wake up beyond it. You can't see through it when you're identified with it. So one way to say that is, unless there is a letting go of what can't be kept, remember everything is in a process of transition, unless there is a letting go of what can't be kept, there can never be the discovery of what cannot be lost. In other words, you must lose your life in order to find your life. You must lose the life you think you're living, which is the dream appearance of identification, fixation, and holding, and grasping, and resisting. Lose that life in order to find the real life, which is boundless, open, and free. Freedom means no more separation. This separation can be so simple as when the eyes rest on a so-called object and there's no thought about the object as out there, or object, wall, person, eyes rest on an object, there's a moment in there of totally simple, unexcited non-separation. Happens all the time for folks, and they overlook it because it's so simple and ordinary. But if there's a resting into that, if there's a really just opening into that space, it's an amazing space of connection where separation just goes. No more separation, no more grasping, no more holding. No more fighting with life, which means there's nothing to escape and there's nothing to acquire. And that can arise, that's called right view, that can arise at any moment while we're sitting. And the reason why I'm speaking about this is because many, many people experience what I'm talking about, but they miss it. Because they're busy being identified, caught up in, invested in things that are more sensational. They've even got it mixed to the point where they think waking up, being free, enlightenment is more sensational than the Hollywood movie. It's more sensational in a pleasant way than my wild and woolly dreams where I fly and stuff. Or whatever you do in your dreams. Some people just want to fly in their dreams. Then they start training to fly in their dreams. Some people want to leave their body as if it's not enough to have a body and figure out how to be in the body. So I can get out of the body. Let me figure out what it's like to go down the tunnel of death ahead of time. And then come back. That's what they do to the Navy SEALs when they're in training sometimes. They actually kill them. Temporarily, I mean, they don't kill them, but they take them into an experience where they face death, and then they let them come back, and I guess they do a debriefing. I hope they do. How do you feel? You get scared? Sometimes people who are against you want to kill you. I think probably it's a good idea if you can be relaxed and open and not react, and then not tell them what they want after they do that to you. Like a waterboarding? I don't think I want to go there. Nothing to escape, nothing to acquire. Life is literally a verb. Life is living itself through everything that's happening. Life is being. This is the way it is. The light is lighting the room. The floor is flooring, the ceiling is ceiling. The body is breathing, the mind is thinking. The body is feeling, the senses are sensing. The voice is speaking. Put an ing after everything. Things are thinging. Thoughts are thinking themselves without a thinker. As the psychoanalytic Vipassana meditator Mark Epstein reminded us with his famous now book, Thoughts Without a Thinker. This is the way it is. Very simple, right here. Never not here. So awareness is the mirror that all is reflected in, and there's no separation between the mirror and the image in the mirror. Sense that. There's no separation between the mirror and the image in the mirror. The image in the mirror, yeah, when the thought enters and says, I'm over here, the image is over there, there's the separation. There's no separation between the image and the mirror and that which produces the image in the mirror. It's all one. So then, very important to see this awareness, which is not an object of knowledge, like thoughts, feelings, perceptions. Awareness can't be known. Awareness is unknown. It simply is. Or you could say awareness is simply being. When there's no looking for anything, you see, when the eyes operate, sometimes we're looking for things. When there's no looking for anything, then there's seeing, and seeing is liberation from striving and seeking. So what am I saying now? I'm saying that even how the eyes work, even just how they naturally work, these eyes, this sense organ, is a kind of expression of the nature of insight. You can't try to have an insight. Let me sit like this, sit like that, see if I can have an insight. Like sometimes one of these lines will stick and then a person starts working on trying to have an insight about that thought that they had. Oh, that's an interesting thought. Anytime you want somebody to say something again, it was like, oh, what was that? That's grasping, actually. The mind is going after something, or you're trying to see something, trying to understand something. What I'm talking about here is not understanding. Awareness can't be understood. It's not an object of knowledge. It simply is. So here are the concepts that are critical to see through. And again, these perceptions, this perceptive mechanism, particularly when it's distorted by not seeing the marks of existence, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and that there's no I or me in any of this body-mind process, concepts arise and eventually they will be seen through. One is time, the concept of linear time. We get in and out of this every day. We often feel a little bit better when we're out of time than when we're in time. When you feel time and you feel it strongly, you feel the weight of time, the pressure of time, you feel that you're not on time, you have to hurry up and get this done. That's all time concept. Okay, notice how in the meditation there's a forgetting of time. Very simply, forgetting of time, don't know how much time passed. Could be because it's unpleasant going on, it's really got the attention. Could be because it's pleasant. Well, time went by fast. That's all a taste of timelessness. Okay, time, measurement of time, tick, 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 is unfolding as a conceptual process in what's timeless. Timelessness. So what's really happening here is timelessness. A That's the first concept. Second concept is birth and death, meaning we believe that we're a separate me that appeared in the body at birth and will die or continue to live at death. We have no idea what we're thinking about. It's just concept. We have no idea. I was born in such and such a date, such and such a time, in such and such a place, because that's what they told me, and it's on the paperwork. That's when the body appeared. This is a subtle one. The concept of space. Most of us have a concept of space. Even if we have that concept of space as a sort of without perimeter type space, that's still a concept. Concept of space is thinking about like the space in this room. That's not boundlessness. Boundlessness is that within which the concept of space arises. Just as well as the concept of time is something timeless that everything's happening in. It's completely inseparable from that which appears conceptually. Next tricky one is purpose. Most human beings are very invested in purpose. What is my purpose? What is life's purpose? What's seen through insight is that there is no purpose. Or you could say it differently. Life itself as it is its own purpose. This is it. Doot. But on to that, where sometimes we have to make up something. What's my purpose? I need to fulfill my purpose. I'm not fulfilling my purpose. Last year I was more on track with my purpose. You see, and if you actually invest it like that, what happens is life comes along in this beautiful, mysterious power, and it just goes scramble. And now you have to say, oh, wait, I'm in a new stage. I'm working on my next chapter of my purpose. Yeah? And you're making it up. Next one is, there's something greater than or outside of this that is here to guide you. Benevolent, if you're lucky, has your best interest, is caring for you, watching out for you, synchronizing your life at times. This is where a lot of people put God. Or if they want to kind of shift it open a little bit more, God, Goddess. Something greater than, outside of this, guiding us. The only thing guiding this or directing this is the Dharma itself, and the Dharma itself is not outside of this. The Dharma itself is this. And I mentioned one aspect of it, which is the force of becoming. Because if you don't get a sense immediately of the force of becoming, just take a look at one of your habits. One of the things that you're compulsed to do, even a little compulsed to do, there's the force of becoming. And the last, but not least, in terms of these concepts, is destiny. And the whole story of destiny is the story of your life in time. Completely subjective, arbitrary, took parts from this situation, that from that situation, parts from your parents, maybe your grandparents, this is your destiny. And not only that, but this is your duty, this is what you need to do. And on that one can go. That's a whole nother rap, and I do mean rap, that if we're not careful, starts to contract our childlike wonder. Because the childlike wonder has no concern for destiny. It has no concern for purpose. It has no concern for space. It has no concern for birth and death, and has no concern for time. So, what am I saying then? These conceptual formations, these thoughts are illusory, not in that they are not happening, but in that in when they are believed to be actually representing life as it is, that's an interpretation, then the life that's open, complete, indivisible, and silently whole is overlooked. It's overlooked. It's still there, but it's forgotten. That's why the Buddha was very great with the riddle when he said, it doesn't matter how long you forget, only how soon you remember. He's saying, remember what is real, remember what is true. Thought appears to make the division between, watch this, the ceiling and the floor. And the thought puts a space between the ceiling and floor. There's another thought. Space, ceiling, floor. There's no separation between these. There's no separation between anything, unless the thought says so. Separation is an illusion. It's illusory in that it's something that actually never happened, but only appeared to happen. That's what is meant by the word dream. Illusion is a dream. Separation is a dream. Unconditioned awareness, and it is unconditioned, it contains everything. It's not limited by anything it contains. It includes and it completely allows everything to be as it is, including the sense of separation born from not seeing things the way they really are. When you see the body as it is, you see the feeling as it is, you see perception as it is, you see the thought as it is, you see consciousness. And there may still be a sense of I somewhere in that mix. When that's seen, it falls open. It just goes plop. And that's what Vipassana is all about. It's completely simple. Completely ordinary. And it's right here. It's right now. The biggest illusion that's being pierced, perhaps even just a little bit, is the illusion that we're not already free. We're exploring freedom from the illusion that we're not already free. It's our illusory thoughts, when believed, that tell us we're not free. Because freedom has been conceptualized as something else, something other than what's happening, an imagination, a feeling, a certain this, a certain that. Some future moment will contain it, some future moment will have it. Some projection of the mind, some ridiculous projection like wearing white, eating vegetables, never swearing and smiling all the time. That's it. That is it. But everything else is it too. This illusion of not seeing that we're already free is the nonsense of distorted perception. Unconditioned awareness is beyond all of it. Unperturbed, unmoving. And that awareness is where freedom lies. And that awareness is right here. Regardless of how tired the mind might get, regardless of how the body's doing, whether it's sick or not sick, whether it's young or old, that awareness that sees is freedom itself. And distorted perception in no way can obscure it. In waking up, distorted perception only seemed to cloud unconditioned awareness, just like the clouds seem to obscure the sky. The sky is there. Clouds just seem to obscure it. Nothing can cloud unconditioned awareness. That's why it's unconditioned. It holds all conditions and it's beyond all of them at the same time. And that's our nature. And that's what Vipassana is about. So in conclusion, I'd like to just read this passage from this Buddhist monk, Ajahn Sumedho. He writes, "If the perception of death is taken personally, then we become frightened because we think we're going to die." Let me read that again. If the perception... Can you see the distortion already? If the perception of death... It's got to be distorted, because we have no idea what we're shooting at. We don't know. We could imagine. We could take somebody else's word for it. It's not going to really be our experience, unless it is. So if the perception of death is taken personally, then we'll become frightened because we think we're going to die. Our perception of being alive is based on the view that this body is mine and that I am this body. So the perception of death is frightening. We live in a world of anxiety and fear over the death of our bodies, separation from what we love, or the mystery of what happens when we die. The Buddha pointed out not to get lost in speculation about life and death, but to see the way things are in our own living experience. And this is what meditation is. It's an investigation, an examination, a profound looking into the way things really are. We examine what the body is, what our feelings are, what makes us feel joy and serenity. What makes us feel joy and serenity, by the way, let me comment on that, is just opening. Just letting go. Holding on to nothing, not waiting for anything. We see for ourselves what desire and attachment really are, and we watch conditions arise and cease. We let the body die when it's time for it to die. If it lives another minute or another 50 years or another 80 years or whatever, that's up to the body. We're in no hurry to die, nor are we trying to live longer than necessary. That's the middle way. We allow this body to live its lifespan because it's not self. It doesn't belong to us. However long this body breathes and lives is all right. It's not mine anyway. But during the time that it's alive, there's an opportunity to die before death. To die to ignorance and selfishness, to die to greed, hatred, and delusion. To let these things die. To let him go, to let him cease. So one is observing death as it's really happening, as the ending, the cessation of these things we tend to regard as ourselves. But actually these things are just mortal conditions. Now he's not pointing out with words the immortality. He's pointing out what dies. The immortality is what doesn't. That's the mystery. So this little piece that he was writing here was called Dying Before Death. Dying Before Death. I should read this too. The way of meditation is to die before the body dies. It's a way of dying before death, dying to death, so that poetically speaking, death is dead. Rather than anything else. By death, I'm talking about the perception in the mind. And that perception in the mind about death is a distorted perception. And that's really the essence of the practice, is to just see that and let it fall open. So let's sit for a minute.